We're in Matthew chapter 6, 22 through 24. Would you like to read that out for me, please?
The eyes are the lamp of the body. So when your eyes are clear, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light is that it is in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? No one can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and wealth.
Now, this scripture has to be taken in context to the overall theme of what Christ is telling his audience right now. What did he previously instruct to them? You can look in your Bible. This is an open Bible test. The previous passage, what is he teaching them? About treasures on earth. That's a hint. Somebody raise their hand. Huh?
Don't lay them up under.
All right. What kind of treasure is referring to?
Gold
and silver and rubies and jewels. That's a symbolic thing. But actually what he's getting at is the trust, you know, what you rely on. And on earth we rely on physical things that we can see. If I've got a fat wad of $100 bills, that gives me confidence in the future because I can pay my bills. I can meet unexpected occurrences. You know, I can be generous. That is a source of comfort to me. I've never actually had that experience. I'm going by theory. But that's the idea. On the other hand, what Christ is saying, look, that's what you look at, but that's not what you can rely on. What you really can rely on is the treasure you put in heaven. That's where you put your trust. Before that, let's back up a little bit more. When he's talking about when he's teaching his disciples how to pray at the end of that. It says in the 15th verse, do not forgive men the trespassers, neither will your heavenly Father forgive trespasses. What's another word for trespass?
Sin.
Can you sin against me? Have you ever done that? I was hoping you'd say no. Okay. That kind of messes up my whole story here, all right? Let's pretend she said no. But I know for sure I've sinned against many people I know. I tend to have a character. I don't think about things. I have a goal and I want to say stuff and I do things. I offend a lot of people. I really don't mean to. So I learned how to apologize very sincerely at early age. But come after this one now. Moreover, in 16 verse, when you fast, not be like the hypocrites. What is Christ referring to here? Who is the hypocrites he's pointing his finger at, Mr.
McKinney? Don't make a show out of your spirituality.
Yeah. What's an example of making a show out of your spirituality, Jonathan? I didn't think he's got the wounded deer in the headlights look.
I have to analyze that a second. But in this case, with the fasting, you know, they were fasting, but the people who he's pointing at were people who wanted everybody else to know, and so, you know,
they disfigure their faces, you know, they go around, maybe a little drool coming out of the corner of their mouth, you know, they did everything but hope a sign saying fasting here. All these things, Christ is instructing his audience, and the overall theme, what would you say though, why is Christ giving this kind of instruction to the people that are listening to him? Some of you, yes, Jonathan.
This whole section starts off with him talking about whether you'll have a reward in heaven or a reward on earth. He says, if you do what you're doing for recognition here, well, that's your reward. You're getting some benefit, some blessing here, but you're certainly getting nothing of lasting value, nothing that you can enjoy later in heaven, honor from my Father. And so it really ties into laying up treasures in heaven later.
That's very good. We're a reward-based mentality. We have a lot of dogs at our house now for years, 30 plus years. We never had a dog in the house. All of a sudden, we have three, including a chihuahua, all right, in our house. So every morning, we have to take them outside, put them in a pen. And the only way you do it is to give them a reward. It got this little chopped up piece of sausage. Here, come here. Put it in. That's their reward. That's what they think about. That's what they work forward to. And you could draw the line to us. You know, what would you do, seriously, if there wasn't some benefit for you physically in that act? You know, would you be nice to your wife if she didn't reward you with a kiss? You know, would you be kind to a waiter if you didn't expect better service? Would you be truthful when it'd be beneficial to disguise something embarrassing you've done? You know, we are a reward-based mentality. There's nothing necessarily wrong with that, but that's the way we think. You know, we do something and we get something for it. Or we do something wrong and we get punished for it. That's the way we think. Now, Christ is giving an idea of a reward that's not tangible, something you can't touch, something you haven't seen yet, something that's in the future, something that we have to strive for nevertheless. And this is kind of hard in this culture, perhaps even more so than ours, to comprehend. Keep in mind, they did not have the New Testament. They did not have this wealth of Scripture that we take for granted 2,000 years. They had the Old Testament, where God specifically said, if you do this, then I'll do this. Now I'll give you this. But if you disobey, if you do this, then this is what's going to happen to you. That is what they existed under for thousands of years. That's their custom. If you were blessed by God, you were wealthy, you were privileged, you had healthy children, many children to look after you in your old age. You know, you had barns full of goods, you had all kinds of servants, you had livestock. If you disobey God, if you were a poor servant, then God would curse you and you'd be a beggar with sores and dogs licking at them and having to beg for your money. That's the mentality they had because that's what they experienced. But Christ is telling them something different. He said, no, it's not about what you get in this world. It's not what happens in this world that's important. It's what happens in eternity. And this was a new thing to them. Come up to where the lamp is the body is the eye. If therefore your eye is good, your whole body be full of light. Let's go to the end of it. Somebody define mammon for me. What is mammon? It's not a little furry rodent that lives up in the mountains. Mammon. Daryl, you're dying to tell us. I can tell. It's on your lips.
Money, or what we call money.
Money. I grew up hearing this as you cannot serve God in money. Anybody, was that the way you were taught? Somebody raise your hand if you were. Thank you, Chris. Yeah. Yeah, I always heard that. You cannot serve both God and money. But that's not necessarily the only definition for mammon. I'm going to ask our pastor if he would like to elaborate on that. I did look this up in Unger's Dictionary.
Did.
Yes, I did.
I did.
I'm putting you out. I'll stop. I just did that pick on you. All right. Mammon is not just money, as in silver and gold and paper money. Mammon is literally physical gain. Some kind of item or object or a thing of value that you can use as currency. That's what mammon is. It can be respect. Now, how many people told a lie when you were a child in order to gain respect from your friends? Yeah, I did that a lot. All right. I came from a family of storytellers, so it kind of came natural. And sometimes I let my good sense get ahead of my common sense. I remember that. And I've known other boys that did. Girls rarely lie. Why is that? Y'all have no lie gene y'all were born with or something? What's another form of mammon that would be important to you other than money? We talked about respect. We talked about money. Oh, come on. There's got to be something besides that. Pride. Yeah. I have a brother-in-law who I will not mention by name, though some of you may know him. If he says he will do something, he will die before he will not do that thing. Here a few years ago, when we were adding on this wing over here, we had to break up some concrete that used to be right there where you're going to where the wing is. And a former pastor was beating on the sledgehammer and had wire in it. It was big chunks, you know, and it's a difficult thing to do. And he was wrestling some of them up into my brother-in-law's truck. And he got one, said, that's too big. We're going to have to bust it up. And my brother-in-law says, well, I could pick that up by myself. And our former pastor said, well, let's see you do it. Well, he got that thing. I mean, this thing, it probably weighed about 300 pounds. You know, it was a whopping chunk. I saw the con crabs on the truck. And he... And our former pastor said, I'll just watch him, went and moved. And he said, no, leave me alone, leave me alone. He almost killed himself. He had to go to the doctor as a result of that a little bit later. But he was, because of his pride, that's mammon, that particular man. Anything else you can think of? Those are the main ones that we have to deal with. There probably are other. Power. That's a good one. Name what kind of power you might find very valuable.
Just a position of a job.
Yes, yeah. Help push and shove your way to the top in the corporate ladder, you know, or stab somebody in the back to get their position, those sort of things. All these things were common to the experiences of the first century people that Christ was directing his comments to, just the same as they're familiar to us today. Now, we're no different. We have different experiences. We have perhaps a broader knowledge. We've been have more things revealed to us than they have. But we're the same people. We're not any smarter than they are. We aren't any brighter. You know, we've got cars and keys that turn them on. We got lights that come on to switch. They didn't have that. We, you know, we sent rocket ships to the moon. We think we're smarter than they are. That's not the case. We're essentially the same kind of people. So you can wipe that smug expression off your face, saying, I would never defigure my face if I was fasting. I wouldn't do that. Yeah. Yeah, if I'd been in that boat, I'd have got out and walked over where Jesus was on the water, and I wouldn't have doubted. Yeah. I've been that. Christ up there on the cross, I'd been right there with him. I wouldn't have been hiding, worried about. No, we'd have been just as scared as they were. You have to deal with it in the context of what Christ is telling. Because he's not only giving instruction to these people, he's giving instruction to people that lived 300 years later, and 700 years later, and 800 years later, and 2,000 years later, and 2,100 years later, and maybe 2,500 years later. We don't know. And that's why we're the same people and the same message resonates the same with us. The lamp of the body is the eye. Therefore, if your eye is good, your whole body be full of light. The simile he's drawing here is, me and Gene here probably have a unique experience, perspective on this. All right? If you cannot see when you want to see, it is very, very annoying. Now, between me and Gene, we have one good eye. I recall years ago on Wednesday night, I would take Gene home in the station wagon we had, and Caleb, who was, what, 8 or 9 years old, would ride in the back seat. So when it gets very foggy up there on the ridge where Gene lives. Alton, you're probably familiar with this. And I would stop the car, and Kay would get out and look and see where the edge of the road was. This fort was paved, and it'd be so foggy you literally could not see. Here we had a man with one eye driving three people in the station wagon. At the time, we didn't think a whole lot of it. But now I'm telling the story, and I see y'all looking at me. What is wrong with you? But that's a simile he's drawing, because blindness was much more common than it is now. You appreciate that. A variety of diseases that are easily cured today, both as an adult and as children, were just devastating at the time. And people were blind quite often. And if you were blind, your prospects were very limited. Nobody was going to marry you, for one thing. Nobody was going to go out of the way to take care of you if you didn't have immediate family to do it. You were reduced to a life of servitude and begging. That's what you did. How many blind beggars does Scripture refer to? Does anybody know offhand? Bartimaeus is one should leap immediately to our mind. But quite, it's frequently mentioned Christ healed the sick and the blind. Blindness was a very common thing in their time. Probably about as common as gluten intolerance is today. You know, everybody has it, seems like. So that's what he's been. The lamp is body, is the eye. If therefore your eye is good, your whole body be full of light. You know, you see, you understand, you comprehend, you can visually interact, you can physically interact. But if your eyes bad, your whole body be full of darkness. Therefore, the light that is in you is darkness. How great is that darkness? Now, what is the analogy he's drawing here? He's not just talking about me being able to see Pastor Russ over there and seeing that bizarre tie he has on. That's not a bizarre tie. I just said that, okay? We're Jerry and Norm when you need them. Boy, I tell you, we had a guy, I don't know how Norm would be. You remember? And he actually brought a tie that lit up little lights on it one time. And we think Jerry Young has bizarre ties. This guy, he would have about purple polka dots with a zebra stripe going through it and stuff like that. Yeah. It just sort of grabbed you by the eyeballs and you just grabbed a hold, wouldn't let go. So he's talking about something that they're familiar with, but he's using terms to explain something deeper. What is the light that he's talking about?
Well, in the context you pointed out, Jesus is talking about what they're focused on. Are they trying to get something good here? Or are they looking at where their treasure will be in heaven? So when he's saying, talking about your eyes, it's like he's saying, what are you looking at? What are you focused on? If the thing you're focused on, you know, is something tangible here, it's the wrong thing. That's darkness. And what a horrible thing, because that's going to affect everything else in your life, he says. If your eye is looking right at darkness, you know, everything you do is going to be based on the wrong priorities, the wrong thing. He says, you know, how great is the darkness because it affects everything.
That's very good. I remember when I was in high school, something stuck in my mind. Most of the chapels we had, and I went Faith Christian, which was a school over there off Old Sparkler Highway. And every Friday we had chapel. And they would bring a visiting pastor or a lot of the preacher boys from Bob Jones up, and they would do chapel at fifth period. Now, I recall that specifically because sixth period was P.E. You know, that's the one class I actually enjoyed in school. And, of course, the preacher or the pastor would get up and say, how long do I have? And the principal would say, take as long as you want. And I'm thinking, no, don't take as long as you want. Don't. And I'd be watching the clock. They'd be sitting there in the third point of a 14-point lesson. And I'd be gone. I'd be looking at the clock saying, when is he going to shut up? Hurry up and get done. And of course, about 5 after, well, we can still get in. And about 10 after, I think, well, if he quits right now. Never got my PE when we had chapel on Friday. Never did. But one thing that I learned at chapel stuck in my head. And it's a computer term, actually, called garbage in, garbage out. Has anybody ever heard this? Okay. Mr. McKay has, I know. It means if you input faulty information into a computer, then you'll get faulty conclusions out. And as you say, when you put garbage into your mind, then that is what you spew out. And this is what Christ is talking about. The things that you see, if your eye is good and if it's full of lightness, or if your eye is bad and is filled with darkness. Now, it doesn't take a rocket scientist or a master of divinity to know difference when Christ is talking about light and darkness. What are these symbolic of? What is the light symbolic of? Somebody on this side of the room. What is the light symbolic about when Christ is discussing it? This isn't hard. I don't have one particular little thing I'm looking for you to say.
Christ is light.
Yes. Over here. What is lightness referring to? Yes, Jonathan.
Well, it refers to being able to see and know God in particular, but truth and reality, whereas darkness is you don't understand, you don't see, you don't know what's going on.
No, just light. Somebody else can work on darkness. You're just working on light.
Well, they go together. It's contrast.
They do, but that's not the way I'm going to do it. Light. Somebody else, that's good. Somebody else tell me, what does light symbolize? A word followed by good, okay? Or good followed by a word.
Righteousness.
Good, righteousness. I like that. Somebody else? Anybody else? I'm going to call on the pastor again if somebody didn't come up with an answer. Good deeds, good morals. good situations. Right. What is the difference between going into a bar and going into a restaurant? Would one be darker than the other, spiritually?
Literally, too, probably.
Well, probably literally also. All right. What is the difference between going to a ball game and going to a bachelor party? A secular bachelor party. You don't have to describe. What is the difference between looking at a news magazine and looking at a men's magazine like you see on the racks over in Ingles? What's the difference between going to a bridal shower and going to a hen party? I guess they still call it that. No. What's the difference between looking at a ball game on TV and looking at a, what do they call them, TV 14 things, or that rating they have, an R-rated movie? Now, what's the difference between that? One is light and one is darkness. And one is lighter and one is darker. You can make that if you're more comfortable with that. That is the thing that Christ is drawing the line between. What do you put in your eyes? What do you see with them? What do you choose to see with them? What do you feed into your body? At least that's my conclusion. Does anybody have a different one? Yes.
Well, I think you hit a key word. What do you choose to look at is the important thing. You can look at anything and reject it, or you can look at something and accept it.
That's a good point. Now, there's some things, especially in our world today, where you just can't avoid seeing some things that you prefer not to see. I mean, you can be driving down the road and look at a billboard or an advertisement. You don't have to be watching a TV or going to a theater. You can just be outside. You can open a magazine and see an ad in a magazine and see something you prefer not to see. Right? I remember when Kay was a young boy. He's probably about 9 or 10 years old. And went to Lewis Williams to get something on a special day they had for sale on. We showed up, and it was Miss Makita Day, where they have a model. She's paid to be Miss Makita, and she wears a skimpy outfit, and they take pictures of her, and she'll sign pictures for you. And I'm thinking, oh, my stars. You know, let's just get it and go, get it and go. So I went and got whatever it was we needed. And the guy ran and said, why are you here going out back and get some hot wings? And, of course, Cabe's always, he's always up for hot wings. And Ryan was, okay, we'll go. Walked outside. And they had the van there to cook, and they had the Hooter Girls there. I don't know if anybody's familiar with them. And Cabe, I'd forgotten this. And Cabe was telling this story to somebody just this week. So Dad walked around with the eyes on his toes the whole time and would not let go of my arm. And I barely got any hot wings before he drugged me off. I remember thinking, I'd forgotten that, but I'm sure I know what I was thinking of. What if Renee finds out? You know, what is she going to say? Now, that was something I really didn't want to experience. But I didn't choose. I mean, it isn't something I really wanted to do, did I? No one can serve two masters. Now, we are constantly at a war spiritually. We're all aware of this. This isn't new information for anybody here. We're constantly at war with light and darkness, with Satan and God, with our own self or being unselfless. Every single moment of the day, that's what we're having to deal with. Now, it's easy to compromise. And we all, it isn't, Satan doesn't get to sin by saying, okay, I changed my mind. I want to wholly do what you want. Now, he gets us to just a little bit at a time. Just be a little tolerant. You know, just look at it a little bit. You know, just, okay, you don't have to do it, but, you know, let your children do it. Or don't correct your children as much as your dad corrected you in this matter. Or, you know, just put up with it for a little while because everybody else does. That is how Satan gets to us. That's how we stop being selfless and being selfish. That's how we choose the darkness over the light. Sometimes we don't even know we're doing it. Really. But we're starting to serve a different master when we do that. Because you can only serve two masters. That's what he's saying. No one can serve. I didn't make that up. I just read that out of the Bible here. No one can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, else he will be loyal to one and despise the other. Now, I'm not saying every time you sin, you're despising God and serving Satan. I'm not saying that at all. Please don't misconstrue what I'm saying here. But we're at least, I remember a quote from Winston Churchill during the Second World War. England was pretty much facing Nazi Germany all by itself, had no allies at all at that time until Hitler decided to invade the Soviet Union. And he offered the Soviet Union, which was full of communists, in case some of y'all might have forgot, his implacable foes that he had spent last 20 years deriding and combating. He offered them an alliance. And somebody criticized it. What are you doing? These have been your enemies. And now he said, look, even if the devil himself offered to be in that alliance against Hitler, I would at least give him a hearing. That is what we're constantly being faced with. We give sin and the dark side a hearing more than we should. And then maybe a little more. And then that selfishness, this feels good. This does something for me. This gains me respect. This helps me on my climb up the ladder. This gives me an edge up in business, or this gives me an advantage in this situation, and just a little bit more. And then we get a better benefit, a better reward from it. And we're geared towards rewards, right? That's what mentally we're experienced with, rewards. So maybe we try a little bit more and we reward a little bit more. And that's so you know, we are indeed serving a different master. There's a boy at work for me. He started out, he came up here from Bob Jones on, Extension. And he would lead the singing and a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And he got out and he joined the Marine Corps. And this was some years back, 2004, 2003, I think, sometime around there. He would come to our house and spend Thanksgiving with us for about 4 or 5 years. And his parents really did not want him to join the Marine Corps, did not want him at all. They even drove all the way down from West Virginia. I remember he was at my shop. He worked for me some. And I remember him showing up, his mama, she just tears coming in her eyes and everything. And I walked out, and he was off talking to his daddy. It was a done deal by the way. He'd already signed the papers. He was going. And I said, now, why are you so worried about this? He says, think of all the young Christian men I've known who have gone into the military and their lives turned into train wrecks. And those are exact words. Or their lives turned into train wrecks. And I wanted to talk to her about this. She really wasn't in the mood to hear what I had to say. But that's why these young men went into the service and started hearing and seeing things that they didn't necessarily choose, but became attractive to them, became advantageous to them, that appealed to their self, that appealed to their baser nature, to their pride and their lust. And they began to serve another master. Now, the point I did make to her, I said, look, the Bible says, if they're in my hand, nobody can pluck them out. Their faith could not have been very real if they couldn't withstand the temptation. That was the point I made to them, made to her at the time. I might say a little bit, I might phrase that a little differently today. This was, 12 years ago. But she has a very valid point. How many young men have left home and young ladies and gone out to the world? And suddenly the things that they're putting into their eyes and into their mind become dark. And they begin serving a different master eventually. Well, I'm not immune with this. You know, people in my family have gone through this exact same thing. And what do you do? There's only so much you can do. Because ultimately it's between the person, the individual, and God. That I cannot, by anything I do or say, really affect your relationship between you and God. God can use things that I say and use things that I do, but it's not something I can determine. It's something the Spirit determines between, say, Gary and God. Now, God might use me as a witness. God might use me to give instruction. God might use me to just be a friend, to show up the flower when he's sick, you know, or help him do something he's having trouble with, to witness to him. Boldly is between the believer and God what your ultimate fate is. Would you agree or disagree with that?
I agree.
Gene, you're the final arbiter here.
I would agree.
With one exception, I would agree.
Okay, give me a second.
You can pray and pray hard, and that will affect.
Effectual prayer of righteous men availeth much. Yeah. Or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Now, same as in the first century. When, remember, these people, it was about reward. If you're blessed, it's about social standing, about fiduciary reward, about comfort, about security in this world. The storehouses that you built there full of goods, the servants you had to take care of you and your family, your position in society, that was what was important. How is that different from today?
Not at all.
There's nothing different between then and now. Yes, Gary.
I was going to say, those who were born with a silver spoon and have a little bit of wealth, they still need to be a good steward of what they have. And so it might even be harder for that person to be on both sides of the coin, if you want to say that, at the same time. But the Lord wants us to be good stewards of whatever He's given us and yet still be with Him.
That's true. The fellow owned Caterpillar. Anybody remember his name right offhand? Probably heard this several times. One time it was a privately owned corporate company. He gave 90% of everything he made to his church. 90%. Say that again.
Latourneau.
On the other hand, we have a politician who was born into money and assumes it's his right. I always thought when Christ said it's for a camel to go through the needle's eye, and it is for rich men in heaven. I never considered he's talking about a Horatio Alger person, like, John here, who pulled himself up by his bootstraps with nothing to his name, a merely sniveling beggar in the streets, figuratively, who became a captain of industry. Now, that's not, I think, who Christ was talking about. I think Christ was talking about the person who was born with a silver spoon in their mouth. Because they have the arrogance and the ignorance that what they have, they can trust in. That what they've always known will always be. That their treasure is already secure. That's a little bit off what we're talking about, but it still applies a little bit. Christ is talking to them too. He said, look, you can't serve mammon, the stuff you trust in, the stuff you want, the things that bring you comfort, that bring you joy, and bring you success. You can't trust in that. Yes, John.
Just thinking about this, we're talking about light and darkness and some of the examples. Maybe we do probably struggle with some of those things too. They're obviously dark. But it really strikes me here that maybe he wasn't even just talking about those obvious worldly things as much as doing good things like giving and praying, fasting even, for the wrong benefit. He's saying you're doing these good things for earthly benefit. And just, you know, it strikes me because the longer I go on deputation, the more it could become a temptation to do all these good things, but get my eye on the wrong benefit.
You know, you make a very valid point. I really hadn't considered that. But has anybody ever said, I want to go on the mission field purely for the respect or the prestige it brings them, do you think? You don't have to answer. That's a rhetorical question. All right. Has anybody gone into the clergy purely for the position that it gives them? Now, historically, this is very true. In many English families, they had pecking order. The oldest son would inherit the estate. The second son would go into the military. The third son would go to the church. That's what they did. They actually have a book in the Henderson County Public Library. And I forget the name of it. But I remember checking it out many years ago. It was something about how to succeed as a pastor. It was something like that. And I thought, well, I'll check it out. And I read a lot of different things. And I got down, and it was extremely frank appraisal of how to elbow and shove yourself to the top of the hierarchy as a religious leader. Clearly. Now, I didn't realize until I was about two chapters in. I was telling Renee, I can't believe this guy. I mean, he's actually, I find dawned on me, this is a parody. And by the time you get to the end of the book, you do. But he made some valid points about, and you can see it in church history. It was the position that was important, not the actual job that was supposed to go along with it. You're supposed to desire the office of a deacon because of what you want to do with it, not because of the notoriety. Notoriety is a bad choice. Because of the prestige that goes with it, okay? Something y'all might not have heard. You know, we take up a deacon's offering, and we didn't realize it, but some of the children didn't understand what that was for. And one I'm having to mention, you know, how much did you get paid? I said, we didn't get paid either. Says, they thought that was what the deacons got paid with, was the money that went in the offering plate, the deacon's offering. That has nothing to do with the story. I just happened to stick it in my head at the moment. So make sure and tell your children what that money is used for. Can you think of any other instances of doing the right thing for the wrong reasons? Did Christ ever give an observation on this? We actually had a play one time that centered around this. We had the kids coming up here during the Christmas pageant. We had a box up there with a slot in the top. And we dressed, I think it was one of them at Christian Girls. You know, we put soot on her face and dressed her in rags. And she had two little Canadian pennies, I think, symbolizing the mites. And it was probably her older sister, dressed in her finery, had come knocking her out of the way to shove a wad of fake Monopoly money into the chest. What instant was that? Yeah, the widow's two mites. And Christ saying, "Don't look, they're sitting there blaring horns and drawing attention to everybody while they put all the money, out of their sufficiency, they're putting a lot of money in here, but here comes that widow and put in everything she had." Now, the rich people were doing the right thing, but they're doing it in the wrong way for the wrong reason. They're doing it to gain prestige or attention, to gain position in society. All of that is mammon. And Christ is saying, you can't serve that. Now, we need money to live on. You know, we need to compete in our position at work or in society or in a game. There's nothing wrong with that. But Jonathan put his finger on it. What do you choose to make important to you? That is what Christ, I think, is getting at here. What is important to you? What do you, in effect, choose to see? If you choose light, then that's what you feel. If you feel, choose darkness, then that's what you're filled with. Comments? Yes, John.
A lot of times when you hear this, they make it, a lot of folks, it seems like it's wrong to have money. It's not wrong to have money. What's wrong is your attitude towards the money and what you do with it between you and God. It's not necessarily wrong to be successful and strive in a proper way to make a good income, like a doctor or a lawyer or someone like that. That don't automatically make them less chance to get into heaven because they're in a financial stable position. But we, with a little money, I say we, you know, what I mean by just normal common working folks are, can be just as sinful with what we have as they are with having a lot by not being obedient when God tells us what to do with our finances.
Anybody else? Yes, Jonathan.
We've talked a lot about rewards today, and something that really struck me a few years ago was the realization that the Lord wants us to live for a reward. He actually values that, and honor, too. Because a lot of times we, and I don't mean honor from men, but honor from God. Because I think we have such a mentality of we have to be careful not to seek accolades or praise or, you know, we try to be humble or put ourselves down, and there's an appropriate place for that. But what he's saying is we should seek honor of him, and it's something that will be in the future. And Jesus actually said that in such a way that he's saying, if you don't, if you're not seeking for the honor that I can give to you, you know, that says poor things about me. He said, you seek the honor that comes from men only, and you don't seek the honor that comes from God. Or in Romans 2, he says that those who are seeking, you know, the wrong things compared to those who are seeking honor and riches and these things from God. And so it's actually okay for us to be looking forward to the Lord praising and accepting us and saying, this was my faithful servant who served me. And so we actually can live for reward, for a treasure. And every time we're doing something for Christ, it's like he's writing it down, he's keeping track, he's laying that up for us. And Paul even says, I know whom I believe, and I'm persuaded that he's able to keep that which I've committed unto him against that day. He was looking forward to rewards day, in a sense, to honor the honor reward of the Lord who's keeping track of all these things, being able to say, you well done, my good and faithful servant. You've been faithful in all these things. So it's something that we actually can look for that, just not from people, not right now, but we do what we do for the Lord, for his eyes, what he sees.
Is it possible to please God? True or false?
True,
because
yes.
Christ specifically says, you know, here's a servant who shows up, does what he's supposed to do, and says, why should he be thanked by his master? He just did what he was supposed to do. Yet at the same time, I recall my father when I was a little boy. Some local rascal curled up and died one day. And my father mentioned to my mother, well, he won't have many stars in his crown when he gets to heaven. Has anybody ever heard of that particular euphemism? It's a backhanded way of saying he was a wicked person. And I wonder, what is that talking about? Well, of course, later I read the passage about the starry crown. Yeah, we can receive blessings. We receive honors from God. But how do we do it if all we do is what we're supposed to do? How do you go above and aboard what you're supposed to do? But that's a different Sunday school lesson for somebody else. Does anybody else have any other comments?
Yes. I think of Ananias and Sapphira. It was okay for them to sell the property for whatever they got out of it, but it was their heart condition that they wanted to be noticed.
They want that mammon, didn't they?
Yeah. Right. How in the world do you keep your right hand from knowing what your left hand is doing? You know, the scripture speaks of that as an illustration.
Mm-hmm.
And I struggle with that all the time. My left hand always finds out what my right hand is doing. And in the meantime, I get a little bit of satisfaction out of it, a little praise, recognition. Help.
Everybody likes being recognized. Everybody does. Okay, you're dismissed. Thank you.